The chain of their steps had stretched through many silent minutes before she asked, "Why did you stand by me tonight? Why were you willing to help me?" He answered easily, almost gaily, "Because there isn't a passenger on that train who needs to get where he's going more urgently than I do. If the train can be started, none will profit more than I. But when I need something, I don't sit and expect transportation like that creature of yours."
"You don't?
And what if all trains stopped running? Then I wouldn't count on making a crucial journey by train."
"Where are you going?"
"West."
"On a special assignment?"
"No, for a month's vacation with some friends."
"A vacation?
And it's that important to you?"
"More important than anything on earth."
They had walked 2 miles when they came to the small gray box on a post by the trackside, which was the emergency telephone. The box hung sidewise, beaten by storms. She jerked it open. The telephone was there, a familiar, reassuring object, glinting in the beam of Kellogg's flashlight. But she knew the moment she pressed the receiver to her ear, and he knew when he saw her finger tapping sharply against the hook, that the telephone was dead. She handed the receiver to him without a word. She held the flashlight while he went swiftly over the instrument, then tore it off the wall and studied the wires. "The wire's okay," he said. "The current's on. It's this particular instrument that's out of order. There's a chance that the next one might be working." He added, "The next one is 5 miles away."
"Let's go," she said.
Far behind them, the engine's headlight was still visible. Not a planet any longer, but a small star winking through mists of distance. Ahead of them, the rail went off into bluish space, with nothing to mark its end. She realized how often she had glanced back at that headlight. So long as it remained in sight, she had felt as if a lifeline were holding them anchored safely. Now they had to break it and dive off this planet, she thought. She noticed that Kellogg, too, stood looking back at the headlight. They glanced at each other, but said nothing. The crunch of a pebble under her shoe sole burst like a firecracker in the silence. With a coldly intentional movement, he kicked the telephone instrument and sent it rolling into a ditch. The violence of the noise shattered the vacuum. "God damn him," he said evenly, not raising his voice, with a loathing past any display of emotion. He probably didn't feel like attending to his job, and since he needed his paycheck, nobody had the right to ask that he keep the phones in order.
"Come on," she said.
"We can rest if you feel tired, Miss Taggart."
"I'm all right. We have no time to feel tired."
"That's our great error, Miss Taggart. We ought to take the time someday."
She gave a brief chuckle.
She stepped onto a tie of the track, stressing the step as her answer, and they went on. It was hard walking on ties, but when they tried to walk along the track side, they found that it was harder. The soil, half sand, half dust, sank under their heels, like the soft, unresisting spread of some substance that was neither liquid nor solid. They went back to walking from tie to tie. It was almost like stepping from log to log in the midst of a river. She thought of what an enormous distance 5 miles had suddenly become, and that a division point 30 miles away was now unattainable, after an era of railroads built by men who thought in thousands of transcontinental miles. That net of rails and light, spreading from ocean to ocean, hung on the snap of a wire, on a broken connection inside a rusty phone. No, she thought, on something much more powerful and much more delicate. It hung on the connections in the minds of the men who knew that the existence of a wire, of a train, of a job, of themselves and their actions was an absolute not to be escaped. When such minds were gone, a 2,000-ton train was left at the mercy of the muscles of her legs. Tired, she thought. Even the strain of walking was of value. A small piece of reality in the stillness around them. The sensation of effort was a specific experience. It was pain, and could be nothing else. In the midst of a space which was neither light nor dark, a soil which neither gave nor resisted, a fog which neither moved nor hung still. Their strain was the only evidence of their motion. Nothing changed in the emptiness around them, nothing took form to mark their progress. She had always wondered, in incredulous contempt, about the sects that preached the annihilation of the universe as the ideal to be attained. There, she thought, was their world, and the content of their minds made real. When the green light of a signal appeared by the track, it gave them a point to reach and pass. But, incongruous in the midst of the floating dissolution, it brought them no sense of relief. It seemed to come from a long-since extinguished world, like those stars whose light remains after they are gone. The green circle glowed in space, announcing a clear track, inviting motion, where there was nothing to move. Who was that philosopher, she thought, who preached that motion exists without any moving entities? This was his world, too. She found herself pushing forward with increasing effort, as if against some resistance that was not pressure but suction. Glancing at Kellogg, she saw that he too was walking like a man braced against a storm. She felt as if the two of them were the sole survivors of reality, she thought. Two lonely figures fighting, not through a storm, but worse, through non-existence. It was Kellogg who glanced back after a while, and she followed his glance. There was no headlight behind them. They did not stop. Looking straight ahead, he reached absently into his pocket. She felt certain that the movement was involuntary. He produced a package of cigarettes and extended it to her. She was about to take a cigarette. Then suddenly she seized his wrist and tore the package out of his hand. It was a plain white package that bore as single imprint the sign of the dollar. "Give me the flashlight," she ordered, stopping. He stopped obediently and sent the beam of the flashlight at the package in her hands. She caught a glimpse of his face. He looked a little astonished and very amused. There was no printing on the package, no trade name, no address, only the dollar sign stamped in gold. The cigarettes bore the same sign. "Where did you get this?" she asked. He was smiling. "If you know enough to ask that, Miss Taggart, you should know that I won't answer. I know that this stands for something." "The dollar sign?" "For a great deal. It stands on the vest of every fat pig-like figure in every cartoon, for the purpose of denoting a crook, a grafter, a scoundrel, as the one surefire brand of evil. It stands as the money of a free country, for achievement, for success, for ability, for man's creative power. And precisely for these reasons, it is used as a brand of infamy. It stands stamped on the forehead of a man like Hank Reardon, as a mark of damnation. Incidentally, do you know where that sign comes from? It stands for the initials of the United States." He snapped the flashlight off, but he did not move to go. She could distinguish the hint of his bitter smile. "Do you know that the United States is the only country in history that has ever used its own monogram as a symbol of depravity? Ask yourself why. Ask yourself how long a country that did that could hope to exist, and whose moral standards have destroyed it. It was the only country in history where wealth was not acquired by looting, but by production, not by force, but by trade. The only country whose money was the symbol of man's right to his own mind, to his work, to his life, to his happiness, to himself. If this is evil, by the present standards of the world, if this is the reason for damning us, then we, the dollar chasers and makers, accept it, and choose to be damned by that world. We choose to wear the sign of the dollar on our foreheads proudly, as our badge of nobility, the badge we are willing to live for and, if need be, to die." He extended his hand for the package. She held it as if her fingers would not let it go, but gave up and placed it on his palm. With deliberate slowness, as if to underscore the meaning of his gesture, he offered her a cigarette. She took it and placed it between her lips. He took one for himself, struck a match, lighted both, and they walked on. They walked over rotting logs that sank without resistance into the shifting ground, through a vast, uncongealed globe of moonlight and coiling mist, with two spots of living fire in their hands, and the glow of two small circles to light their faces. Fire. A dangerous force, tamed at his fingertips, she remembered the old man saying to her, the old man who had said that these cigarettes were not made anywhere on earth. When a man thinks, there is a spot of fire alive in his mind, and it's proper that he should have the burning point of a cigarette as his one expression.
"I wish you'd tell me who makes them," she said, in the tone of a hopeless plea.
He chuckled good-naturedly. "I can tell you this much. They're made by a friend of mine, for sale, but, not being a common carrier, he sells them only to his friends."
"Sell me that package, will you?"
"I don't think you'll be able to afford it, Miss Taggart, but—"
"All right, if you wish."
"How much is it?"
5 cents.
5 cents? She repeated, bewildered.
5 cents, he said, and added, "In gold."
She stopped, staring at him.
"In gold?"
"Yes, Miss Taggart."
"Well, what's your rate of exchange?
How much is it in our normal money?"
"There is no rate of exchange, Miss Taggart.
No amount of physical or spiritual currency, whose sole standard of value is the decree of Mr. Wesley Mooch, will buy these cigarettes."
"I see."
He reached into his pocket, took out the package, and handed it to her.
"I'll give them to you, Miss Taggart," he said.
"Because you've earned them, many times over, and because you need them for the same purpose we do."
"What purpose?"
"To remind us, in moments of discouragement, in the loneliness of exile, of our true homeland, which has always been yours too, Miss Taggart."
"Thank you," she said.
She put the cigarettes in her pocket. He saw that her hand was trembling. When they reached the fourth of the 5 mileposts, they had been silent for a long time, with no strength left for anything but the effort of moving their feet. Far ahead they saw a dot of light, too low on the horizon and too harshly clear to be a star. They kept watching it as they walked, and said nothing until they became certain that it was a powerful electric beacon blazing in the midst of the empty prairie.
"What is that?" she asked.
"I don't know," he said.
"It looks like—"
"No," she broke in hastily.
"It couldn't be.
Not around here." She did not want to hear him name the hope which she had felt for many minutes past. She could not permit herself to think of it or to know that the thought was hope. They found the telephone box at the 5th milepost. The beacon hung like a violent spot of cold fire, less than 1/2 mile farther south. The telephone was working. She heard the buzz of the wire like the breath of a living creature when she lifted the receiver. Then a drawling voice answered,
"Jessup at Bradshaw."
The voice sounded sleepy.
"This is Dagny Taggart speaking from—"
"Who?"
"Dagny Taggart, of Taggart Transcontinental speaking."
"Oh. Oh, yes, I see."
"Yes?"
"Speaking from your track phone number 83. The Comet is stalled 7 miles north of here. It's been abandoned. The crew is deserted." There was a pause.
"Well, what do you want me to do about it?"
She had to pause in turn in order to believe it.
"Are you the night dispatcher?"
"Yeah."
"Then send another crew out to us at once."
"A full passenger train crew?"
"Of course."
"Now?"
"Yes."
There was a pause.
"The rules don't say anything about that."
"Get me the chief dispatcher," she said, choking.
"He's away on his vacation."
"Get the division superintendent."
"He's gone down to Laurel for a couple of days."
"Get me somebody who's in charge."
"I'm in charge."
"Listen," she said slowly, fighting for patience. "Do you understand that there's a train, a passenger limited, abandoned in the middle of the prairie?"
"Yeah. But how am I to know what I'm supposed to do about it? The rules don't provide for it. Now, if you had an accident, we'd send out the wrecker. But if there was no accident—" "You don't need the wrecker, do you?"
"No, we don't need the wrecker. We need men. Do you understand? Living men to run an engine."
"The rules don't say anything about a train without men, or about men without a train. There's no rule for calling out a full crew in the middle of the night and sending them to hunt for a train somewhere. I've never heard of it before."
"You're hearing it now. Don't you know what you have to do?"
"Who am I to know?"
"Do you know that your job is to keep trains moving?"
"My job is to obey the rules. If I send out a crew when I'm not supposed to, God only knows what's going to happen. What with the Unification Board and all the regulations they've got nowadays, who am I to take it upon myself?"
"And what's going to happen if you leave a train stalled on the line?"
"That's not my fault. I had nothing to do with it. They can't blame me. I couldn't help it.
You're to help it now.
Nobody told me to.
I'm telling you to.
How do I know whether you're supposed to tell me or not? We're not supposed to furnish any Taggart crews. You people were to run with your own crews. That's what we were told.
But this is an emergency.
Nobody told me anything about an emergency.
She had to take a few seconds to control herself. She saw Kellogg watching her with a bitter smile of amusement. Listen, she said into the phone. Do you know that the comet was due at Bradshaw over 3 hours ago?
Oh, sure. But nobody's going to make any trouble about that. No train's ever on schedule these days.
Then do you intend to leave us blocking your track forever?
We've got nothing due till number 4, the northbound passenger out of Laurel, at 8:37 a.m. You can wait till then. The day trick dispatcher will be on then. You can speak to him.
You blasted idiot! This is the comet!
What's that to me? This isn't Tiger Transcontinental. You people expect a lot for your money. You've been nothing but a headache to us, with all the extra work and no extra pay for the little fellows.
His voice was slipping into whining insolence.
You can't talk to me that way. The time's passed when you could talk to people that way.